WYLL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this June 10th, 2012. Got a live show for you today. It's going to be a great show. We have as our guest Paul Krugman, the award-winning economist, Nobel Prize award-winning, talking about his new book, End This Depression Now. We're in a depression, but we don't have to be. Professor Krugman will explain why for the next hour. But before we go to our guest, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Even with an anticipated bank sector bailout of $100 billion or more, Spain's prime minister is forecasting a rough year for his nation's economy. Mariano Rajoy is forecasting that unemployment, now at 25%, will continue or even rise there. In Greece, pharmacists are asking the European Commission to give money to the country's main healthcare provider to avert a massive medicine shortage. Joannica Kiss reports from Athens that the healthcare crisis is worsening just days before crucial parliamentary elections.
Five associations representing Greek pharmacists are requesting $1.9 billion from the European Commission's Task Force for Greece. In a letter to Task Force leader Horst Reichenbach, the pharmacists say the money is needed to save the nearly bankrupt state health insurance fund. The fund relies on social security payments, which have declined sharply because of rising unemployment. Thousands of Greeks use the fund to buy subsidized medicine, but the fund owes pharmacists millions of dollars. The pharmacists have stopped selling prescriptions on credit, causing panic among Greeks who can't pay cash. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kikissis in Athens.
Voters in southern Arizona go to the polls this week in a special election to replace Gabrielle Giffords, the Democratic congresswoman who is still recovering from an assassination attempt. Andrea Kelly has details from Arizona Public Media in Tucson.
Republican Jesse Kelly is calling voters, and his volunteers are walking door to door to remind people to vote for him Tuesday. Democrat Ron Barber's volunteers are doing the same.
This is a flat-out race to the finish. We have to get our people out to the polls.
Barber is Gabrielle Giffords' former district director, and she's backing him in the race to fill her former seat. Barber is running against the same man who narrowly lost to Giffords in her last race. She made a rare public appearance to show her support for Barber during a concert Saturday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Early ballots are coming in at a record pace. Both campaigns predict it will be a close race. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Kelly in Tucson, Arizona.
Off the coast of Alabama and the Florida Panhandle, torrential rain has led to millions of dollars in flood damage. Pensacola's been hardest hit, taking on more than 13 inches of rain yesterday. And forecasters say more rain is on the way.
4 to 8 inches is certainly possible, maybe some locally higher totals. So any additional heavy rainfall over a short duration is going to add to the flooding concerns that we've already seen. And so we have a flash flood watch out for all of coastal Alabama and northwest Florida.
National Weather Service forecaster Jeff Beeman. From Washington, this is NPR News. Four staff members of the International Criminal Court continue to be detained in Libya, with the War Crimes Court in The Hague demanding their release. As Terry Schultz tells us, the team was in the village of Sintan to meet with the son of deposed leader Muammar Gaddafi, held since his capture in November.
ICC President Sung-hyun Sung says the court is very concerned about the safety of four staff members believed to be held by militiamen in the town of Sintan. Hyun says the team members have diplomatic immunity and must be let go immediately. The ICC wants to try Saif Gaddafi in The Hague for alleged war crimes committed against Libyan civilians, but the new Libyan government says it wants to hold the trial itself. The former heir apparent to the Gaddafi regime was captured last fall by armed fighters in Sintan, who are unwilling to hand him over to any other authorities. The ICC has expressed concerns in the past about the conditions under which he's being held. That's one of the issues the team being detained was in Zintan to check out. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
Leaders of congressional intelligence committees are calling on the Justice Department to move deliberately with its probe of possible unauthorized disclosures of classified information. The Attorney General has authorized an investigation of leaks about U.S. involvement in cyber attacks on Iran and drone strikes on suspected terrorists. Fans of the cable show Cake Boss will soon have the chance to taste Buddy Valastro's creations. He's collaborating with the company that supplies ingredients to create a grocery store-ready cake line. First out this summer, Buddy's Bada Bloom cake with bright green frosting. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, someone who hasn't been on the show for a few years, it is Paul Krugman, the recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics. He's also a professor of economics at Princeton, author of a number of books, probably best known to the listeners to Media Matters as the New York Times columnist who writes on economics and politics there a couple times a week. Paul Krugman is also the author of the brand new book, End This Depression Now, which I just had the privilege of reading, and we'll be talking about it for the next 53 minutes. I hope you'll join us. Professor Krugman, thank you for being on the air with us.
Great to be on.
Well, let's start with, as I understood it as I read your book, and I don't think you're being quite explicit about it, the two main points you're making is that we're in a depression, and we don't have to be.
That's right.
And why don't you just elaborate on what you mean by depression, because that's a term that's used loosely, and then explain quickly, shorthand, why we don't have to be.
So I think the right way to use it is to say that a recession is when things are going down, and a depression is when things are down, even if now and then they may get a little bit better. So, you know, the Great Depression was a terrible plunge for the first part of the 1930s, then a moderate recovery, but one that still left mass unemployment, then another recession, then another recovery, but we didn't get to anything like full employment until close to World War II. So we call that whole episode the Depression, because even though sometimes we're worse than others, it was all really, really bad times. So the Depression, I think we need a word for an extended period when the economy is not, strictly speaking, in a recession, but it's not GDP is rising, not declining. We might even be adding a few jobs, but it's a really, really bad state of affairs all mm-hmm. the same. And the thing is, this is not, our ability to produce has not declined. We are not, we haven't had a tsunami. We haven't had a plague of locusts. Whenever people talk about, there's a problem with the skills of American workers, no more so than there was 5 years ago. This is something that is just a kind of a failure of coordination. There are people willing to work, there are jobs that need to be done, and it's actually quite easy, as far as the economics goes, to end something like this. People, in 1939, lots of people said mass unemployment was going to be a permanent thing. And then we began a burst of government spending, which was in preparation for World War II, and all of a sudden we had full employment. And we could, if it weren't for the politics, we could do the same thing right now.
Professor Krugman, I heard an interview with Paul Ryan, who's sort of the Republican Party's resident intellectual economist, I guess, a couple years ago. It was a striking interview because he was talking about, someone said, shouldn't we raise government spending? And he said that in the Depression in the 1930s, the government tried that throughout the 30s, and it was a complete failure. And the only thing that got us out of the Depression was World War II.
Which was government spending.
Of course. I mean, yeah, I that was the point I'm making. It was a sort of absurd situation.
Yeah. And by the way, if you actually look at it, people talk about it as if it was the 30s, nothing worked. The fact of the matter is, the U.S. economy grew really fast from 33 to 37 thanks to New Deal programs. They just weren't big enough to get us back to full employment, but they did pretty well. And if there was a second leg to the Great Depression, a downward big fall in 37, 38, but that's because the austerity guys, the same people who have been telling us all that we need to slash spending now, got to FDR and convinced him to back off on the policies that he had been following. So it really is the case that it's as simple as that. Get us to spend some more and get the government to spend, not forever. We can talk about budget balancing later on, but not now, not while the private sector is still recovering from a financial crisis.
Our guest, Professor Paul Krugman, author of the brand new book, End of This Depression Now. Professor Krugman also writes for the New York Times. He's a columnist and teaches at Princeton University. The phone lines are open at Media Matters. If you'd like to call in and ask Professor Krugman a question, 217-333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've got a lot of ground I want to cover, Professor Krugman. One thing I would like to ask you about, a common figure in your books, a very prominent figure in economics, is John Maynard Keynes. You talk about him. You referred yourself as a Keynesian. His name is used a lot. Maybe you could give a little background for listeners who haven't studied economics, aren't really familiar with him.
Okay, so Keynes was, the first thing you want to say is he was in a way very much an insider of his time. He was somebody who knew all the great and good and who knew the economic theory of his time, but who was also someone who was willing to say, the world is not working the way I was taught it works. He was saying that even before the Great Depression, he was willing to say, look, there really is a problem with unemployment. There really are things going wrong. And he wrote this book, which is, if I may say, not recommended reading for most people. I don't think I even would recommend it to economic students in their 20s. It's best to come back to that 20 years later, but because it's a densely written book. But in the end, the point was, it is possible, and in fact common, for there just not to be enough spending in the economy. There are times when, for a variety of reasons, consumers and businesses are not going to spend enough to make use of the capacity, not going to be willing to employ people, even though they are willing to work. And those are the times when the government can and should step in to spend more to create employment. And that's a point of view. There's now 80 years worth of evidence that says that's right. It's not a religious text. It's not that because John Maynard Keynes said something, it's true. But the basic truth of his insight about how things work, and particularly about depression economics, is overwhelmingly vindicated. And we're seeing it vindicated as we speak when you look at the effects of austerity in Europe.
Yet at the same time, although the evidence sides that way, looks that way, and the historical record looks that way, the closer one gets to policymakers in Washington, D.C., the further it seems we get away from the Keynesian argument.
Yeah, and there's a number of things going on there, one of which is that we've had a decades-long propaganda campaign against any kind of Keynesian economics. We've had Ronald Reagan telling us that the government is always the problem, not the solution. We've had denunciations of anything like this thought, which actually goes all the way back, even when Keynesian economics was being brought to our universities in the 1940s. There was an organized and often effective pressure campaign by wealthy individuals and by corporations to prevent it from being taught. And the reason is it's threatening. Even though it's not socialism by a long shot. I mean, Keynes himself said he thought his theory was moderately conservative because it's about saving capitalism, not replacing it. Once you start to say that the government can do things to fight unemployment, you're doing two things. One is that you're saying that government can do good things. If government can do good things, maybe it actually needs sometimes to raise some taxes at the expense of rich people to pay for those good things. And the other is you're saying that the way to prosperity is not by being nice to business people, not being nice to corporations and bankers and trying to win their confidence, which is one of their favorite themes. And instead, the way to create jobs is to create jobs, which is a very threatening thing if you're somebody like Jamie Dimon, right, who says the important thing is not to upset Wall Street because if we feel nervous, we won't lend and spend. So I think what's happened is our whole political climate has been warped by this long, long propaganda campaign against Keynesian economics, which is a shame because now is when we need that economics more than ever.
Professor Krugman, if I may say so, that last point you made, which is in the book around page 94 and 95, and I sort of highlighted it, I wouldn't say you buried the lead, but I'd say that is such an extraordinarily important point for explaining the paradox that there are policies that can solve the problem that would actually benefit those who are wealthy, yet they oppose them. And, you know, I think for a lot of Americans, that's very confusing. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, but, you know, I'd say certainly the hard right in this country plays a long game. They're not short-run guys. They're willing to invest large sums of money in creating a ideological climate that will serve their interests in the long run. And even though, I mean, they would be better off in the short run from an economy that recovered. And also people, I think there is still some paradox there. I think there are still kind of a maze. I mean, if you look at Wall Street, certainly Wall Street has very consistently actually done better under Democrats than under Republicans. And nonetheless, a lot of these guys are very Republican. They think about the taxes the Democrats want them to pay, the very modest taxes Democrats want them to pay, and they don't think much about the fact that Republicans have pretty much consistently mismanaged the economy. So, yeah, it is a paradox, but what I guess the thing I can say from having been out there in the public domain is there's a limited number of people who are willing to let evidence move them. They believe what they want to believe, especially if it seems to correspond to their perceived self-interest.
Our guest, Paul Krugman, author of the new book, End This Depression Now, just published by Norton. Paul Krugman writes for the New York Times. He's a professor of economics at Princeton and is the recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics. This is a book I strongly recommend to people interested in the economy. It's very well written, as anyone might imagine who's read Paul Krugman's columns in the Times. And I might say it also covers a lot of ground that isn't in your columns. There's a lot of fresh material here, like the point we were just talking about, this paradox. And Professor Krugman, let's go through a couple of the key points that come in the book that I think are important, which, first of all, a term you go to constantly, but I think it's very important for people to understand current political debates over the economy, is the term liquidity trap. And, you know, what is a liquidity trap? Why is that important? And once you understand that, where should that push you?
Okay. Yeah, it's one of those terms that, in a way, I wish we weren't stuck with it because it doesn't mean anything to most people. And it's not even, we're stuck with it. So think about the fact, normally when we have a recession, we have an ordinary garden variety recession, it's not even really a political issue how to deal with it because it's technocratic. We've got the Federal Reserve, which is this quasi-independent, not totally, but sort of kind of independent agency that can have a very strong impact on short-run interest rates. They can add or subtract from bank reserves, which moves interest rates. And they can deal with a slump in the economy by pushing those interest rates down, which ordinarily helps. So businesses become more willing to borrow, mortgage rates come down, housing picks up, and they can get us out of the recession just by cutting interest rates. No need to pass legislation, no need to make a case, really. It's just done by a technocratic agency. Trouble is, what if you have a really severe hit to the economy? What if you have something like a monstrous housing bubble fueled by a huge increase in household debt because people were told by bankers not to worry and because banks dropped their standards and so on, and then that bubble bursts? Then even cutting interest rates all the way to zero is not going to be enough to get the economy back on track. And that situation where zero is not low enough, where you can take the interest rates that the Fed normally controls and bring them as far down as they can go because they can't go below zero. Try and reduce interest rates below zero and people will just sit on piles of cash. The fact that you can't get that a zero rate's not low enough, that's a liquidity trap. And liquidity trap means that you really have no alternative if you want to boost the economy but to have the government step in. That is no longer the case that you can rely on Ben Bernanke or Alan Greenspan before that to deal with the problem. There's more stuff that Bernanke can do, but it's not going to be the same. It's of limited effectiveness. And it means also that a lot of your preconceptions about the economy just go completely wrong. You're sort of through the looking glass. So you normally think, for example, that the government borrows, that may be, you know, that's competing for funds with private business, and so that's going to mean lower investment. But in liquidity traps, well, interest rates are already zero. The government can borrow. It's not going to drive up interest rates, as in fact it has not. And what instead is going to happen is that if the government borrows and spends, the economy will be stronger and businesses will have more reason to invest. And so instead of government borrowing actually hurting private investment, it actually helps private investment. There's a whole set of things like that. It becomes a very different world. It's not a common state of affairs. This is our, for the United States, this is our second liquidity trap in 75 years. The last one was during the 1930s. But when it happens, the rules of economics change a lot, and you really need to have policy that reflects that change. Of course, we don't.
As I understand it, Professor Krugman, and I'd love to get your take on this, we have roughly $2 trillion in cash that's more or less on the sideline that's not being used in productive investment right now. And so the idea would be the government would borrow this money at fairly low rates and put it in circulation to get the economy cooking. Is that a crude but...
Close enough. I mean, you want to think that basically there's all kinds of... There's both money and people begging to be used. And nobody wants them. There's 13 million unemployed workers who would love to have jobs and are sitting there and eager to take employment if only jobs were made available. And there's trillions of dollars of private money sitting on the sidelines because it doesn't see any safe investments. Does money beg for a job? Well, sort of. I mean, that money is willing to... If you look at bond at investors, they're willing to lend the U.S. government money long term at an interest rate of around 1.6% right now. And if the government sweetens it by offering protections against inflation, they're actually willing to lend that money at a negative rate. They're willing to pay the U.S. government mm-hmm. to take their money and do something with it. So all of these resources ready to be used. Sometimes people say, well, the government should be run like a business. But business had really good investment opportunities and could borrow for free, and then had the workers sitting ready for use to do those things, it would be crazy not to do it. And yet we don't do that. Instead, we're all talking about cutting government spending.
Our guest, Paul Krugman, author of End This Depression Now. We're live on Media Matters and WILL AM 580 today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller. Line 1, Coles County. You're on the air with Professor Krugman. Coles County, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, you're on the air with Professor Krugman.
Yes, Dr. Krugman. I'm going to change the topic. Yes, I am.
Hello?
Yes, yeah, turn you. Off your radio. I think we're on delay, so turn your radio off.
Okay, it's off. All right. It seems like, you know, obviously for the past several hundred years, as we've grown our economy, produced more products, people overall have had healthier and more contented lives. But we're also now starting to seem as if all this creating more products is also threatening the environment and causing its own health problems. So as someone whose interests are in economics and politics, when do you see that being a problem, that with the, you know, our idea that by growing the economy, eventually we'll have everyone being prosperous and contented? Do you see a tension there where maybe that won't work in the long run?
Well, I mean, there's environmental issues are really serious. And by the way, if you do your economics right, they don't aren't in conflict with economics. You're supposed to take those costs into account. And there is a way to deal with that, which is to give people an incentive to take environmental impacts into account. So this is very standard textbook economics that you should have if you're doing pollution, if whatever you're doing causes pollution, there should be a tax on those pollutants so that you have an incentive to minimize them. Or if you can alternatively do it by creating a limited number of licenses and having a market, which ends up having pretty much the same effect. So people, again, have to pay a price for polluting. And if you do that, you can simultaneously have economic growth while reducing the impact on the environment. So it's not there's no inherent contradiction. Now, in practice, we don't do it nearly enough. In practice, we have we've dealt with things like acid rain. We managed to sharply limit that damage by creating a market in sulfur dioxide emissions. We dealt effectively via regulations with some other things. We were really in danger of creating a gigantic ozone hole, and with fairly modest regulations, we limited that impact and so on. But there's a lot of stuff we haven't done. But the problem is with our lack of political willingness to get the incentives right. Of course, the willingness to accept that sometimes the government needs to intervene in markets to steer them in the right direction. It's not the economic growth per se that's the problem. We could have a society that was much richer. I mean, I hope if we survive all this stuff we're going through, 100 years from now, we'll have a society that is much richer than the society we have right now, and at the same time does a lot less environmental damage. But it's the politics of getting there that's the hard part.
Professor Krugman, let's talk about right now, because a lot of your writing in the New York Times and a good bit in this book is about the political situation, specifically in the United States. We'll maybe have a chance to talk about Europe later in the program, because you talk about it in the book. But in the United States today, you know, one of the points you make in the book is that, you know, when you have a depressed economy like the United States has, it leads to political turmoil that can oftentimes lead to, you know, very dark scenario. I mean, where do you see the politics of this country right now with the Republicans and Democrats, with the nature of governance and political debate, and how it's the capacity it's showing for dealing with the severe problems this country's facing?
Well, it's pretty bad. We have no center. That's been developing for quite a while. And it's not symmetric. So I shouldn't plug someone else's book, but Mann and Ornstein have a very good book now called "It's Even Worse Than You Think." And there are long-term congressional experts who finally say the simple truth, which is that the fundamental thing that's gone wrong in American politics is the growing extremism of the Republican Party. That means, of course, that we have at best paralysis. We have a blocking of effective policies by the Republicans when they're in opposition. And the way the U.S. system is set up, you don't have to have a majority to be able to effectively impede any kind of action. And the other thing you have is the if you like, the triumph of bad ideas. It's been truly amazing to see how this economic crisis, which should have been a wake-up call to anyone who believes all of this stuff about the perfection of free markets and the wonders of financial deregulation, has in fact been just brushed off. It took only months for the American right to rewrite history and make it, somehow it all became Barney Frank's fault, roughly speaking. That's a really bad recipe. You've got a situation where we have severe economic crisis, which will not fix itself, or at any rate will fix itself very slowly, and you have a death paralysis at worst, quite possibly after November, government by people who have been wrong about everything and are determined to continue being wrong about everything and turn that into actual policy. It's not encouraging.
Now, you have been, I would say, a critic, a friendly critic, but a very sharp critic of the Obama administration. And in the book, you talk about their economic policy making. And if I'm summarizing, correct me if I'm wrong, that there were debates within the policy team of the Obama administration early on for how best to proceed. And in your view, the good guys didn't win.
And partly was because I was concerned about the politics. It seemed to me, I'm afraid I was right about this too, that there was a window to get this stuff right early on, but they needed to be extremely aggressive in dealing with what was, after all, a, a once in 80 years economic crisis. And instead, they were cautious, or they were, it was half measures. They could have done more. They certainly should have been willing to take more risks on the political side to get stuff through Congress. And they didn't. And the result has been that they ended up discrediting, even though what they were following were basically the right policies, by doing them halfway or a third of the way, losing a lot of credibility and, of course, losing a lot of political clout. And then they compounded it, or I can say the president compounded it, by the arguments of his enemies. That at a time, there was this great, completely wrong-headed shift of focus away from job creation to deficits, which is something that you want to do, not now. You want to do once we're out of this depression. But the president joined in with that, and so they just handled it. Not to say, important to say, that this doesn't mean that the two parties are the same, and it makes no difference who wins. It makes an enormous difference. But it was a real disappointment. Regular readers of my column will recall that I was tearing my hair out.
No, apoplectic is the term I would use.
Yeah, because I worried that we would see what has in fact happened, which was that by doing too little, by listening too much to the voices of caution and the voices of conventionality, that the president would throw away his one real chance to get this right. And so it proved.
Our guest, Paul Krugman, author of the new book, End This Depression Now, just published by Norton. I urge you to take a look at it if you're interested in what we're talking about, economics, the current depression, what to do about it. Paul Krugman is a professor of economics at Princeton. He writes a regular column for the New York Times on the op-ed page, and he's a recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics. Let's go back to our phone line now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Krugman.
Good afternoon to both of you. I have a comment followed by a question. Now, my comment is, in the early 2000s, the IMF, World Bank, and the austerity puritans predicted economic catastrophe for Argentina were they not to adhere to the standards set out by the IMF and the World Bank. I'm just wondering if Paul Krugman could address maybe some of the learning points that we might learn from the Argentinian example vis-a-vis Europe, the United States, and maybe any other part of the world. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Professor Krugman?
Yeah, and a lot of parallels. The IMF was preaching austerity. There were, and in particular Argentina, was something part of the euro. They had a supposedly irrevocable peg, one peso, $1 forever. And the IMF telling them to stay with it and all of that, which they didn't. They couldn't in the end. And it was nasty a few months. And a lot of corruption when the thing fell apart. But then there was a pretty impressive recovery that came once we're no longer shackled to this standard. Interesting thing now is that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, they're actually, as these things go, they're the good at this point. Not always, not consistently, but they are at least relatively open-minded. As I've actually been, I met with them in Iceland, which is one of the few countries that has actually been seriously unorthodox here and has benefited a lot from it. And the IMF team is all for it. But I did talk in the book. I picked up a phrase actually from Duncan Black, the blogger, who uses the term "very serious people," capital V, capital S, capital P. The very serious people have been preaching orthodoxy, been preaching austerity and hard money and all of these redemption through suffering throughout this crisis. And have been wrong at every stage and have been really, really destructive in the process. Strong echoes, if you know your history.
our guest, Professor Paul Krugman, here in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Krugman, it's very it's an honor to speak with you. I've always been following your work as long as I first heard about Krugman. I've always enjoyed reading the concise way that you write. Weekly, I kind of get a quick window what's going on, and I can move in from there. The question that I have for you is that the way that you've succinctly summed up the problems for the American economy right now, I have a six-year-old daughter, and every once in a while, I'm going about my day, and I just look over at her, and I think about the future, and I'm very curious about how you might see the next 2 years. I don't even know if you could possibly even look that far out. But I'm just kind of curious. The next 2 years, I think, are going to be very weird. And
yeah, well, it's going to be very weird. So first, So, I mean, first of all, there's Europe, which is galloping towards some kind of moment of truth very soon. And that's going to be absolutely wild and there, and I have to say, the European policy elite, they're ready to bail out banks, but they seem still not to be able to grasp that that isn't enough. So God knows, that could be a real blow up very soon. Then, okay, we're having this election, in case you haven't noticed.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at this point, the realistic range of prospects, I'd love to think that we could actually have a workable progressive majority again. I guess it's just possible, but not likely. Not at all likely at this point.
Well, I remember reading George Liakoff's book, Try Not to Think of an Elephant, and the concept of framing the argument. And
yeah.
I feel that while perhaps Democrats loosely have a grasp on an idea to move forward successfully in an equitable sense for everyone, we've lost the argument to loud voices. And
kind of curious. It's a long story there. I mean, if you can see that from some of the that even Democrats whose hearts are in the right place that tend to be way too deferential to Wall Street and all of that. But so the likelihood, so one possibility is we had Mitt Romney in the White House, who is not a stupid man, but is at the beck and call of a party that is just basically insane, and which, if it actually gets to implement the policy agenda, will set us into a full-on Great Depression. On the other hand, we may have re-elected President Obama, who can do some things, but will be not a whole lot, and we just have to hope that the natural recuperative powers of the economy, which do exist, are going to help. No, it's ugly. And you know, I have. I have relatives. They're right age, but they're looking, looking for jobs, and it's not nice out there. I mean, we have bundled this big time.
Yeah, in fact, I have children, teenagers in early 20s, and a lot of my friends do, and I teach them like you do. So, this labor market has to be the worst, certainly in my lifetime, and I suspect you'd have to go to the 1930s. And what was really striking, Professor Krugman, the New York Times had a front-page story within the last week on what's happening with working-class kids who graduate high school, don't go to college of any kind, but enter the labor market. And I don't know if you saw that story.
I did, indeed. And it was, I mean, basically, as I said, we talk about the terrible prospects of the youth in Greece right now. But a young American with a high school degree and no college degree is not in much better shape. It is incredible, the devastation. And for those with college degrees, and also these days with a lot of college debt, it's really pretty bad, too. There are 4 million Americans older. So now we get to be older, but there are 4 million Americans who have been out of work for more than a year. That has not happened since the 1930s. This is a catastrophe, and it's a continuing catastrophe, which incredibly, not only are we not addressing it effectively, a lot of people in Washington just act as if that's not our main problem.
And what's striking to me is this, even if we do muddle through somehow, like the Obama administration probably is wishing we would have, sort of, you know, normal recovery, those sort of problems aren't going away. They're not going to get the wages moving way up. They're not going to create millions of jobs for, you know, 19-year-old working class kids.
Right. I mean, first of all, the kids who are graduating into this nightmare market right now, they're never going to make up the lost ground. It's going to shatter their whole lives, which in turn is going to mean that it's going to, by the way, that they're going to pay fewer taxes than they would have otherwise, which means that even if you really are worried about budget deficits, this is not helping. It's not as if we were a paradise in 2007. We were a country of declining wages for many workers, of rising inequality. 2007 only looks like prosperity because things have gone so completely to hell since. But we certainly are a society with big problems. But, you know, not staying in this depression doesn't make it easier to deal with those problems. We need to get out of this, and then we need to work on the longer-term reforms.
In your book, you talk about, at a couple of points, John Maynard Keynes' critique of speculation and the financial superstructure overshadowing the productive base of an economy. And it's hard to read Keynes, and actually a lot of economists for that matter, prior to quite recently, that weren't really quite critical of excessive financial sector in the economy and speculation. What would you do? What would your recommendations be for addressing this spectacular growth of the financial sector so that it's, you know, considerably larger as a portion of our economy and has much more political influence than it did, say, 40 years ago?
Yeah, well, we have a model for how to deal with it, which is what we did in the 30s, which was both some guarantees, deposit insurance, and a lot of regulations, regulations that on capital, requiring banks to not be too leveraged, regulations on reserves, probably less important but not irrelevant, limitations, basically saying if you are going to be, if you're going to have government guarantees, then the quid pro quo for that is that you as an institution can't do a risky investment. And I think what we need to do is we need a 21st century version of all of that, which is some of which we have a financial reform bill, Dodd-Frank, which is not a stupid piece of legislation. It's Dodd and Frank, Barney Frank in particular, they understand all this, but they face political limitations. So what they did was they set up a bunch of ways in which regulators could try to crack down on these excesses. The trouble with it is it's not at all automatic, and so under the wrong management, the regulation is not going to be effective. But that's the thing. It's not the case that this is the way things have to be. We ran for 50 years after the 1930s with a basically a financial sector that screwed up now and then but did not produce major financial crises. And we could do that again. What we need to do is we need to just understand that that wild speculation is not, in fact, a productive economic activity, and that leveraging yourself up and playing heads I win, tails somebody else loses is not deserving of being the highest paid occupation in our society.
You know, this gets back to the, I found like Johnny One Note here on this issue, but if there were ever a moment in recent American history in which a politician could successfully make that case to the American people, it would have been in January 2009.
I try to not spend too much time, water under the bridge. But yeah, it was a very unhappy thing. We can talk. You know, that would be a whole other show about that. But yeah, people. I'm afraid a lot of progressives thought that Barack Obama was really a figure that shared their view of a progressive transformation of America. And he was actually much more of a conventional guy. A guy with his heart in the right place, a guy who's smart, but someone whose first instinct certainly then was to turn to establishment figures for advice. And that was a really bad mistake.
We've got three callers waiting very patiently to speak with Paul Krugman, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm going to try to get to all three. Let's start with line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Yeah, I guess I need to lament the the pollution of economic discussion. The chat shows this morning were particularly obnoxious, and maybe not just because you weren't on it this morning, but I wanted to get back to sort of the frame, a big frame that was put on the discussion at the very beginning about, well, there's $2 trillion in cash that the corporate interests basically have, and it wouldn't be, and interest rates are low, so we could easily borrow and put people back to work that are getting laid their pink slips right now in the public sector. But what about the whole idea of, neither of them are going to happen, but what about the idea of saying, why should we have to borrow money from rich folks? The taxes are clearly skewed wrong, and there should be at least some call somewhere for taxing this, I don't know, idle wealth tax.
Yeah.
Is that confiscatory, and that's going to be too much? You'll be called socialist, even though you're not?
Well, thank you, caller. Well, Paul Krugman?
Yeah, I think the answer is that there's nothing wrong. I certainly would support higher taxes on higher incomes. There's a lot of reason to believe that from a society's point of view, those taxes are just could be substantially higher, could be another 20% or so higher or more. It would still be to our advantage because what we can do with the money would be worth more than whatever modest incentive effects it would have. Right now, tax increases are not some of the tax increase would be reflected in smaller spending on the part of rich people. So this is not the greatest time to do it. Although that wouldn't stop me from doing it if I thought it was politically possible. The point is, you're borrowing the money, but you're borrowing the money at very, very low interest rates. So it's not like this is a big giveaway. And at some level, we do have all of this idle capital that we want to get put to work. We're not going to be able to tax all of it away. So let's go ahead with the borrowing, especially because that can be done very quickly. Part of what I try to say in this depression now is that at this point, it's not hard. We don't need an elaborate, innovative program. We can get a long way just by supplying, resuming aid to state and local governments so they can rehire all those hundreds of thousands of school teachers and firefighters that they've laid off. That right there is a big step out of this depression, and it could be done on a few months' notice if only we could get our politics together.
Let's go now to line two, Pasotum. You're on the air with Professor Paul Krugman.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed your interview on the BBC the other day, Professor Krugman. My question is, I grew up or came of age in the early 70s, and it seems just like when everything changed. At that time, you could go to the bank or savings and loan, and you'd get 5.25% interest, and you would be encouraged to save your money, small people. And then it seemed like everything hinged on the stock market, and rather building a company to increase and improve the company, it was whatever it took to maximize the price of the stock, including obviously closing plants or doing whatever. And I just wonder if I know it's a long involved question, but could you give me a short synopsis of what happened?
Yeah.
Thank you, Colin.
A big change in our political story, and my view is that that the politics led the economics. I mean, it certainly didn't help that we had the inflation of the 70s and the oil shocks, which were all kind of a period of mismanagement, although it's amazing to me that really relatively brief, about 7 years of economic troubles, which somehow loomed totally dominating American people's imagination, and the fact that we're in now year five of a much worse slump doesn't seem to bother people as much. But anyway, a couple of things. The right got organized. This early 70s is when they really started pouring money into their ideological apparatus. Civil rights, famously LBJ told Bill Moyers that by passing the Civil Rights Act, he was giving the South to the Republicans for a generation. And he was wrong. It's two generations. Civil rights, unfortunately, meant that what had previously been a solidly democratic area, which was vicious on race policy, but relatively open to government action in other areas,
became hardline conservative, and that shifted the political constellation in America. So that's, I think, the story. It was this kind of left-field fact of the backlash against civil rights, plus the fact that, unfortunately, the malefactors of great wealth got their act together.
Yeah, referring to the 1936 campaign of President Roosevelt, the re-election campaign, probably the most left-wing or populist campaign of the 20th century by a major party candidate.
Yeah, that speech he gave at the convention in 36 is still a keeper.
And what's striking is how to get those words out of the mouth of Barack Obama would take more than an electronic crowbar. I think it would be unthinkable.
Donald Rumsfeld, you know, you go to these things with the presidents you have. I mean, Obama's never going to be the populist, the golden tongue populist of our dreams, but he's a good man, and he learned. He's also a man who's capable of learning, and I'm much happier with what I hear from his economic team now than what I heard from him 3 years ago.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to line 3, Champagne. You're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Yes, Professor Krugman, I wanted to ask if you could explain briefly about how these other countries in Europe have gotten into the economic problems they're in. Are they related to all the same sort of cause, or are they separate things like different tax rates? I know Ireland has an extremely low corporate tax rate, things like that. Have they all contributed to this, or is
no? No, so the European, now Greece is an outlier. Greece is a funny case where they really did have irresponsible borrowing by a conservative government, by the way. But if you look at the rest of them, it's actually the same story that we have here, but with the extra problem of not having of having one currency without one country. So Spain is Florida. Think of them as basically being the same. Spain and Florida both had monstrous housing bubbles, inflated partly by purchases of holiday homes. You know, it's Costa del Sol and Miami Beach are basically the same story. The difference being that when the bubble burst in Florida, at least the Social Security checks and the Medicare checks are coming from Washington, and so they're not a state-level responsibility. In Spain, they are. There is no European government. So what was just a horrible recession in Florida or in Nevada or in California here becomes a fiscal crisis in Spain and other countries around Europe in a way that isn't happening here. So the story, it's not about, you know, basically the same story. We had runaway banks, both sides of the Atlantic, a little different in the details. We did fancy financial footwork. They did more plain vanilla stuff, but it was still crazy. And the result when the bubble burst was terrible economic catastrophe in all of the regions that had the biggest bubbles. But the difference, because in Europe, is that those regions are also countries which are now in deep trouble. So there you go.
Same
story, basically.
Yeah, Professor Krug, when I was studying economics, macroeconomics back in college in the 1970s, it was presented that if a national economy like the United States got in trouble, was in a recession, one of the factors that would help it get out of a recession, but other countries would be doing better and they would buy American goods and help the economy sort of get back on its feet. And I think that was probably a factor why Japan, when in the 1990s it entered its deep deflationary stagnation period, didn't entirely go down the tubes as the rest of the world was still buying Japanese products.
That's right.
Now we're in a situation where Europe is in trouble. The United States is stagnant. China, which has been the growth engine of the world, the fastest growing economy, now apparently is its leaders are acknowledging is slowing down quickly. Are we entering that sort of stars in alignment moment where we could be sort of teetering at a place where the entire world is heading south at the same time?
We were there for a while in 2009. Then the emerging markets like China seemed to trouble Europe. Yeah, I mean this is the nightmare scenario. This is the 80-year flood. And sure, it's
one of those things goes on in Europe. The Germans go around saying, well, you know, we had our troubles around the late 1990s and we pulled ourselves out and why can't anybody else? And the answer is, yeah, you did it by running a gigantic trade surplus vis-a-vis the rest of Europe. So are you now proposing that everybody should run a giant trade surplus at the same time? Who is the other planet we're going to be exporting to?
Our connection, unfortunately, Professor Krugman, is going in and out right now. Fortunately, we only have a few minutes left. Let's go back to the phone lines to our last caller. Line 1, Urbana, you're on there with Professor Paul Krugman.
Hello. Yes. I have a question and a comment. I'd rather pose the question first. Is the economy at present, and even if it were to somehow recover, is it capable of producing sufficient jobs for full employment without government hiring and employment?
Okay. I think the answer is yes, but there's still lots of stuff that, for people to do. We have lots of there's no shortage of things that people want to spend money on. So I don't think we don't need a permanent WPA style program. A temporary one right now would really be helpful.
Okay, the comment caller. Hello, caller. Well, it looks like we've lost our caller, Professor Krugman. We're down to just a few minutes left, Paul. And let me just ask you, you've been recently in the United Kingdom, and you've been writing quite a bit about that. What is the importance of what's happening in Britain for us in America?
The British are – I always – international stuff because not – they're – they offer, if you like, we can either tell about what we're doing there. So the British have embarked upon hard it. They embraced this austerity thing in a way.
Professor Krugman, I think we've lost you at our end. Maybe you could move to another room. I know you're on your mobile phone. Are you still there?
I am still here. Can you hear me?
I hear you now perfectly. So whatever you're doing,
that's
keep
very
doing
strange.
It.
I'm really sorry about this. As you probably know, we had some problems with our local company here that decided to cut off our landline access. Can you hear me now?
I hear you perfectly.
Okay. So, yeah, so the nice thing about the British is that they're doing it wrong in a way, and they're doing it wrong deliberately with intent. So we get to watch the failure of their policies that tells us what we should not do. And it's especially helpful that they speak English so we can – it's not hard to follow the ins and outs of their debate and watch them – and watch their leaders refusing to admit that they've screwed up. So Britain is a very useful object lesson.
We only have a minute or so left, Professor Krugman. Are there any politicians in America today who on economic matters you think have really got a better sense of how to resolve this than the ones we've been talking about?
Oh, wow. Well, no, really. Let me just say a word for Obama's what I thought was bobbling it early on. But I do talk to his officials, I have talked to him, and they learn. So, you know, we don't need, there are people who are better, but this is the difference between the parties right now. One part is capable of learning from its mistakes. So I'm actually relatively happy about what I'm hearing about they would do this.
Well, on that note, Professor Krugman, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much, Paul Krugman, for taking your time to join us.
Thank you so much.
You have a great week. Paul Krugman, author of End This Depression Now, published by Norton, has been our guest today. I want to thank Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back with you in 167 hours. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for Champaign-Urbana today, mostly sunny skies, the high 88 degrees, winds up to 20 miles an hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies, the low around 70 and winds up to 15 miles an hour. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high 85. Monday night, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain, the low 68 degrees. Tuesday, mostly sunny skies, the high 82 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL.